Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats. On today's show, fermentation.
The microbiome is this complicated assemblage of bacteria and viruses and fungi and microscopic multicellular creatures that exist within all of us. And these trillions of little beings help us to do everything in our daily lives.
Anthropologist Andrew Flax approaches the microbiome from more than one perspective. Barbara Lair explains kombucha, and Sandor Katz gives us the basics on making sauerkraut at home. It's easy and delicious, really, like nothing you'll find in a store. Trust me. That's all just ahead on Earth Eats. Alex Chambers has some food news for us. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Kate. I've got news today about the EPA's not-so-new rules on who can apply pesticides, and about an essential crop for millions of people that most Americans may not even have heard of. As of last week, the minimum age of pesticide applicators will stay at 18 years old. The EPA had been pushing to drop the age to 16. On the same day President Trump nominated former coal lobbyist Andrew Wheeler for EPA administrator, the agency said it would withdraw its proposal to lower the minimum age of farm workers to handle, mix, or apply pesticides. The Environmental Working Group's Ken Cook was relieved, saying dangerous pesticides that can cause cancer and brain damage should never be anywhere near children. There was no age minimum for pesticide applicators before the Obama administration updated the EPA's Agricultural Worker Protection Standard in 2015. In addition to the minimum age for applying pesticides, Wheeler also said the agency would keep two other Obama-era provisions. The EPA will continue to require exclusion zones, which keep workers away from newly applied pesticides, and designated representatives, who oversee farmers' records about their pesticide use. For farmers in Africa, Asia, and South America, cassava is a staple crop. The root, also known as yucca or manioc, survives in poor soil, weathers droughts, and can be harvested year-round. But the varieties grown in Africa have low yields, and the more productive ones in Asia and South America are vulnerable to blights. Severe outbreaks of the cassava mosaic disease sparked famines in the 1920s and 90s, and a new strain is now spreading across Asia. Worldwide, more than 800 million people rely on cassava. But unlike wheat, corn, and rice, agronomists have not put much work into improving it. Until now. Researchers at the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture in Nigeria are using genomics and selective breeding to forge strains that are more productive and resistant to blight. The scientists have developed 8 new strains that are now growing in test plots around the world. The hybrids are the result of DNA analysis from around 2,500 seedlings germinated in 2013. Last October, researchers found a genetic marker in their seedlings for beta-carotene. That means their plants are likely to produce vitamin A, a nutrient many African diets lack. Scientists at the institute plan to hand-pick the best varieties to distribute across Nigeria next year. The team is also coordinating with counterparts to expand in Thailand, Laos, Brazil, Uganda, and Tanzania. And that's the news. Thanks to Taylor Killo and Chad Bouchard for those stories.
And thank you, Alex. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Kate.
Fermentation and fermented foods continue to be hot topics all over the food world. From high-end chefs creating specialized fermented pickles to homesteaders putting up large crockfuls of sauerkraut. And you might be hearing stories about possible health benefits from eating yogurt every day or drinking kombucha every chance you get. Fermentation is on the lips in more ways than one.
My name is Andrew Flax. I'm an anthropologist at Purdue University, where I'm an assistant professor.
Andrew Flax spoke with Kane Ferguson of the IU Food Institute and myself this fall when he visited the Indiana University campus for a talk on fermentation and the microbiome. He and his colleague Joseph Orkin are approaching the topic from more than one angle. And for them, getting to this topic was an interesting journey in itself.
So most of the work that I have done so far has been looking at how people learn about their environment and use agricultural knowledge and use new technologies to shape landscapes, and how all of that fits together into traditional ecological knowledge, and how that knowledge and practice is structured by the political economy and these larger forces that determine who does what, where, and when, and the ecological consequences of that.
For Andrew, this meant studying cotton farmers in South India, who were facing an agricultural crisis that led to extremely high rates of farmers committing suicide. The response to the crisis included farmers shifting their growing practices to either genetically modified crops or to organic farming. Andrew Flax studied the processes of farmers gaining knowledge about various growing methods, choosing growing methods and particular seeds, and the effect of these choices on the agricultural landscape.
I'm starting to realize with this new research that's coming out on the microbiome that we do the same things every time we make food and every time we eat that food. We're having the same processes of knowledge and technology and becoming every time we make something like a fermented food, and every time we eat it, we're actually changing the landscapes inside of ourselves, these microbial landscapes that we all have, that I have, that you have, and ours are a little bit different based on the diets and the places where we grew up. The microbiome is this complicated assemblage of bacteria and viruses and fungi and microscopic multicellular creatures that exist within all of us and exist within every animal, and we're starting to realize exists between plants as well, plants and fungi. And these trillions of little beings help us to do everything in our daily lives, from digest our food to help our immune systems function, to help our bodies transmit signals, to helping plants and fungi transmit signals to each other as well. So they're really involved in every aspect of life as we know it. They're just unseen. This is just this invisible world that we're creating with the foods that we eat and the things that we do. I started thinking about this with some of the work that I do in India, where every day, every meal will include at least one bowl of yogurt that has sat out and is kickstarted by yesterday's yogurt. And this is what you eat to finish off your meal and to be healthy, usually at the end of the day. I myself grew up with my grandmother's kosher dill pickles, which were harvested from the garden, lightly kind of washed and then thrown in with a mix of spices and oak leaves to ferment and become delicious and sour. When you put all of these vegetables together, say in the pickle example, and you submerge them in salt, you're essentially creating, you're doing what a farmer would do, because you're creating a landscape just on this microbial level. You're creating conditions where certain species will do well and certain species will not do well, except that instead of like chickens and pigs and cotton, we're talking about lactic acid producing bacteria. Salt turns out to be, and heat turn out to be, things that produce tastes that we humans like very much. So in the case of the pickles, putting in that salt creates an environment where some bacteria don't survive very well and others thrive. Some of those that thrive are lactic acid producing bacteria. That lactic acid, it tastes good to us, but it also, in combination with the salt, kills off any bacteria that might be kind of harmful to us. So this is a way that many, many cultures around the world for generations have used to preserve food in the absence of refrigeration, which is a fairly new technology. This bacteria then goes on to kill off any of these things which might be harmful, and over time that acid intensifies until we've got a much reduced ecosystem on our microbial level. And we're left with really only these things that taste good and happen to be relatively helpful for us. So my main research is in food and agriculture, and these questions of how do we shape the environment, how does the environment shape us, which are classic anthropology questions, and anthropologists have been looking at this for a long time, including here at IU. In my research on genetically modified crops and organic agriculture in India, the questions were all about how do we make that decision of which seed to plant? And there's lots of larger forces that go into this seemingly small decision that then determines everything about your agriculture and the kind of landscapes that you live in. On the microbiome project, it's that same kind of combination of knowledge and practice and heritage within the larger just political and economic day-to-day that we live in that drew me to that same research, because not only are you creating a landscape every time you make pickles or sauerkraut or yogurt, but it's becoming increasingly clear that when you eat all of that stuff, you're very rapidly and reliably reshaping the microbial ecology inside of you in ways that might, and this very new project, so we don't know for sure, but in ways that might be extremely beneficial for human health and for well-being, in addition to being delicious, in addition to helping us interact with our heritage and connect with our roots. Myself and my colleague, Joseph Organ, who's at the University of Calgary, who's a geneticist, and he does a different side of this project with me. Together, we traveled down to Liberty, Tennessee, and we got to meet a major figure in fermentation revivalism, which is this guy, Sandor Katz. And this speaks to what we think is kind of new and interesting about this project and this approach to fermentation, where we're taking a cultural investigation of these topics, which is my job. So I'm a cultural anthropologist, and I interview people, and I participate and observe in different kinds of practices to learn more about them and to learn how practices become embodied. This is all very important if we want to ask about knowledge. And what Joe Organ does is, as a geneticist, while I was interviewing people about their histories of fermentation and some of these heritage recipes and how they got into this and observing how we made these things, Joe was taking samples of all of these different pots of fermented foods and vegetables and brines and preserving them in liquid nitrogen, so that we could then see what sorts of influences ultimately came together to create this microbial landscape, which we would then be able to genetically measure using metagenomic sampling techniques. If we're really interested in how this microbial landscape in our food shapes the microbial landscape within us, there needs to be some kind of biological sampling. So I mentioned that my job is talking to people and eating food and hanging out and having a good time with other people. Joe's job, in part, was to collect people's stool samples every day so that we could then essentially have a real-time, day-wise understanding of how this microbial community in this fermented food that I'm eating then comes out in my stool the next day, and how much of that potentially probiotic landscape survived through the gut system we would then be able to measure through, again, metagenomic sampling later in the laboratory. So we're trying to combine all of this, all of these different angles through interviewing and learning these techniques and seeing what's alive in the fermented foods and then seeing what's alive in people's stools to understand really fundamentally how culture shapes our health. My understanding of this comes out of my reading of the medical literature. Now, most medical findings are done through the process of clinical trials. And clinical trials are great. They're a fantastic way to understand how one specific input, whether it's a chemical compound or a specific bacterium in this microbiome case, or a specific process, is going to have an effect, because we can cancel out all of these other confounds and variables. So it's really helpful if we want to say with certainty, like, X compound has this effect on health. So most of the research on fermentation and fermented food health benefits comes from clinical research like that. And that's how we know that there are some benefits for the ability to digest lots of different kinds of foods and digest them better. That's how we know that there are links between certain kinds of lactic acid producing bacteria and a reduction in depression and anxiety. That's how we know that there are links between some of these fermented foods and what may be anti-cancer agents, agents that will, in general, improve the functioning of our metabolism and also our autoimmune systems. And that's really important work being done by people who are not me and are not Joseph Organ. Because what we're looking at is more of the real life example, because diet is very complicated and really tricky to study. These kinds of nutritional studies which is the best work that we have, or even self-reported data, it's difficult to make great conclusions about that because people aren't very good at remembering this information. And people in general aren't very good at keeping track of that kind of thing. If we really want to understand how this dietary input of fermented foods has an impact and what kind of impact it has, we want to qualify that impact, we really have to be there in the moment with people, and that's doing anthropology. So that's not going to happen in the same way in a clinical trial. It doesn't reflect reality in the same ways that this more participatory approach does. In a clinical trial, confounds are bad. In the scientific method, what you're really trying to do is break down a problem into a yes or no kind of answer. Yes, I can say with certainty this variable, which is not being influenced by any other outsider variables, has an impact on the thing that I'm trying to study. If there's a confound, then other outside forces are coming in and disturbing that really neat interaction that we want to study between variable and outcome. And so if these outside things come in, then we can't say for certainty, yeah, that's the variable that's really causing the impact that we're seeing. In anthropology, confounds are life. And so that's what we're trying to do with this project. And so we're able to say different kinds of things, and this is a very new project. And certainly we're very grateful to all this work that's giving us leads and potentialities to follow.
Am I correct in understanding that you got into the fermentation because of spending time in India? Not because of necessarily the research you were doing, but because of the diet and lifestyle that you were exposed to.
Yes. Academically, I became interested in fermentation in this way because of the kinds of local food practices that I was seeing. You eat a chicken that is one of these local heirloom chickens. In Telugu, the word would be a desi chicken. This is one of these like country chickens, and you eat it with chilies and tomatoes that were grown right in that land, and you eat it with the rice that was grown in the paddy that's right next to the field. You get to taste that area. You never get better home-cooked meals than in places where there's a vibrant agricultural life. As to the actual fermentation project, if I were being completely honest, this project began in conversations with Joseph Orkin and myself at our local deli, as both of us were finishing up our PhD dissertations at Washington University in St. Louis. We would often go to Pratzel's Deli in St. Louis and have a sandwich and discuss these things that we were working on. Joe was sequencing the stools of free-ranging gibbons in Yunnan, China, to try and understand conservation from this genetic perspective. I was trying to make sense of agricultural knowledge and seeing how people shape landscapes around them. And we kept finding ourselves converging on this idea of landscapes big and small and the ways that we kind of shape ourselves and we are shaped by the environment. Not just my Indian farmers, not just Joe's free-ranging gibbons, but also ourselves every time we were eating these pickles, which we knew were just teeming with lots of delicious lactobacillus bacterium. And we started to wonder what sorts of effects these have, because I had grown up hearing from my grandmother all of these stories about how good pickle juice is for you and it's restorative. This is something I've confirmed with many people of Slavic heritage, that pickles and ferments are things that you do to keep strong. I heard the exact same logic in South India, where I was given this locally produced buffalo milk yogurt, which is a higher fat than cow milk. It's 8%, and man, is it delicious. And I was told that this was something that was going to keep me well because it was imparting all of these good qualities onto me. These were things that Joe was finding in his research in pickled vegetables throughout southern China. And so being anthropologists, we really wanted to tie all of this together and to figure out, well, what of this can we measure? What of this has some kind of influence? How do we study the influence of heritage and taste on our health and well-being? And this just seemed like a great way to tie all of these things together. One of the things that I really want to just emphasize here in all of these studies is that it's really important to try and understand these really complex issues, whether it's something that is immediately very serious, like agrarian crisis and suicide and the future of agriculture. I mean, whether it should be genetically modified crops or organics or something in between. And these things that might seem a little more frivolous, like how do we make the world's best sauerkraut? It's very important to understand these from as many different perspectives as possible through this combination of mathematical tools that we have at our disposal, so surveys and spatial information and genetic sequencing, but to make sure that that's always in service of the larger, bigger questions, which are things that we get through more qualitative approaches, talking with people, participating, observing, becoming parts of communities, and trying to tell their story as well as we can. It's great because I think I've really lucked out on the fermentation project, you know, where I'm talking with people and eating food and my poor geneticist colleague is going around hitting up people for their poop. I feel like I really lucked out on this one.
You can find out more about Andrew Flax, his colleague Joseph Orkin, their current research on fermentation and the microbiome, and their previous projects. We've got links on our website, eartheats.org. And in a moment, some ideas to get you started on your own fermentation projects, should you feel inspired to do so. Up next on Earth Eats. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. If all this talk of fermented foods and the microbiome has you anxious to try some fermented foods for yourself, we've got a 2016 piece from Earth Eats reporter Aubrey Cedar on how to make the fizzy fermented beverage known as kombucha.
It's noon at Mother Hubbard's cupboard. Barbara Lair is setting up for her weekly class called Fermentation Friday. It should be noted here that Barbara is not a trained nutritionist or a doctor or a scientist. She offers her knowledge about fermented foods and teaches students how to make various kinds of fermented foods because they have been beneficial to her health personally. Today's class is about kombucha, the fermented tea that Barbara has been making for herself for 6 years. It can cost as little as $2.50 to make a 2-gallon batch of kombucha. Makes me feel like a sucker for paying $3.49 for 16 ounces at the store. Barbara's first patron comes in around 12:30. And is excited to watch the kombucha demonstration. She has had kombucha before and likes it, but thinks that the prices for store-bought kombucha are way too high.
It's like $4. I can't justify that.
No, obviously. Okay, so basically, you turn sweet tea into kombucha by adding what's called a SCOBY.
They look like octopi. They do.
They're so gross. But it's actually...
She's right. It's pretty gross. When she brought out the jar of SCOBYs, it reminded me of a sea creature preserved in formaldehyde. Not necessarily something that I'd like to ingest. SCOBY, by the way, is actually an acronym that stands for Symbiotic Colony of Bacteria and Yeast.
And this is what turns sweet tea into kombucha. It takes about 10 days.
Okay. You're probably not going to find SCOBYs on the shelves at your local big box grocery store. Barbara got her first SCOBY from a friend.
Part of the process of brewing kombucha causes the SCOBY to multiply itself. And I have patrons from the hub who learn how to make kombucha, and then when they come back for another Fermentation Friday class, we'll bring their extra SCOBYs. So we usually have enough to share. So after 10 days, about roughly, when this is done, then you pour all of the kombucha off of the SCOBY, right? Mm-hmm. But actually you save back a little bit, because in order to brew your kombucha, you need some kombucha and the SCOBY.
Okay.
So you want to keep some of that. It kind of jump starts the fermentation process for the next batch. After you've done that, that's when you can second ferment it. When you second ferment it, that's when you get the good fun flavors. And there are all sorts of different kinds of flavors. You can do almost anything to flavor kombucha. I really like lemon and ginger. I also love elderberry and cinnamon.
Wow. Very, very great. Yeah. I have a recipe that I can send you.
For Earth Eats, I'm Aubrey Cedar.
If you didn't catch all of that, we dug even deeper into the plentiful Earth Eats archive for a detailed recipe on how to make your own kombucha. EarthEats.org. Our guest Andrew Flax mentioned fermentation revivalist Sandor Katz in his interview. He's well known in the world of fermentation with several books out, including The Art of Fermentation. Earth Eats founder and former host Annie Corrigan interviewed Sandor Katz on our show a few years back. In this excerpt, he gives a compact version of a Fermentation 101 workshop.
The realm of fermentation that I think makes the most sense for most people who are wanting to explore this for the first time is fermenting vegetables. It's incredibly simple. All you do is take some vegetables, chop them up, shred them, create some surface area, salt them lightly to taste, spend a few minutes in a big bowl with your hands just squeezing them, bruising the vegetables, and they'll start to get really wet. Once the vegetables are nice and wet, then you stuff them into a jar. Press really hard, get the vegetables pressed down so that they're submerged under their own juices. Then ferment them for a few days or a few weeks. It's really an incredibly versatile process. It is intrinsically safe. There is no safer food. There has never been a case of food poisoning reported in the United States from fermented vegetables. There are very few foods that you could say that about. You don't need any special equipment. You don't need a lot of background. I have just given, your listeners, as much information as they need to get started. Okay, well, thank you so much. Great to talk. Bye-bye.
Find the entire interview with Sandor Katz on our website, including a recipe for an Afro-Brazilian ferment of black-eyed peas. It's called Acaraja, and you'll find it at eartheats.org. That's all we have time for today. I'm Kate Young, and thanks for listening to Earth Eats. And thanks to everyone who helps with the show, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Andrew Flax, Kane Ferguson, Annie Corrigan, Aubrey Cedar, Barbara Lair, and everyone at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, and Sandor Katz. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. We'll be back next week. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com.